In the show coming up, we're going to listen to Mehdi Hasan. He's critical of mainstream media for its dehumanization and racism toward Palestinians. Then we're going to listen to a show that's produced in Melbourne, Australia. It is broadcast on a community radio station down under, and it is a show about the genocide happening currently in Palestine. Following that, we will listen to a Double Down news report, which was produced for Al Jazeera, and it is titled What Happened October 7th. And finally, we will hear a statement by Bernie Sanders, a U.S. Senator from Vermont, and this is a media release that he issued April 18th. Now here is Mehdi Hasan taking on mainstream media and its misuse of the language with regard to the genocide that is currently taking place.
Comfortable using to describe Israel's relentless killing of over 30,000 Palestinians in Gaza, including over 13,000 children, whether they were sheltering in hospitals or schools or in mosques or churches. And yet these are not words that tend to be used by Western media outlets, in particular by American mainstream media, to describe what is happening in Gaza to the Palestinians as they are killed in record numbers and in some of the most brutal ways imaginable. They're rightly used for Israeli victims, yes, but not for Palestinians. Oh, no. And you don't have to take my word for it. The numbers don't lie. A survey of articles in the New York Times, the Washington Post and the LA Times, reported on by The Intercept back in January, found that the term slaughter was used by editors and reporters to describe the killing of Israelis versus Palestinians 60 to 1. And massacre was used to describe the killing of Israelis versus Palestinians 125 to 2. Horrific was used to describe the killing of Israelis versus Palestinians 36 to 4. What else do we call that other than the deliberate dehumanization of the Palestinian people? Remember when the Associated Press referred to the 12,300 Palestinian minors killed by Israel? Can't say the word children. Oh, no. They're Palestinian. They're not innocent. They're not human. It's not just US newspapers, but US television, too. In a study of the guests who appeared on Sunday morning political shows in the first 3 months after October the 7th, Dr. William Eumanns found that not only were the American guests who appeared on air more than twice as likely to sympathise with Israel than with the Palestinians, but that overall, there were 10 times as many Israeli guests as Palestinians. 10 times. What else do we call that other than the deliberate dehumanization of the Palestinian people? And it's not just the US media. The UK's isn't much better. A study of the BBC's online coverage of this issue, published by a pair of data scientists in January, found a systematic disparity in how Palestinian and Israeli deaths are treated. See, Palestinians, per the BBC, tend to die or be killed, but very rarely are they murdered. No, that term is almost exclusively reserved for Israelis when it comes to this war, with a 101-to-1 Israeli-to-Palestinian ratio. In addition, words like mother, daughter, father, son were much more likely to be used for Israeli victims of Palestinian violence, but not so much for Palestinian victims of Israeli violence. They just tend to be nameless, faceless numbers, statistics. What else do we call that other than the deliberate dehumanization of the Palestinian people? Look, the Western media's coverage of what the International Court of Justice has called a plausible genocide unfolding in front of our eyes, in my view, is perhaps the greatest, most consequential, most shameful media failure of our lifetimes. Only the media's coverage of Iraqi WMDs and the non-existent threat from Saddam Hussein back in 2003 comes even close to what we've all had to see, read and hear in recent months. So it's difficult to overstate just how dehumanized Palestinians are, not just in our media discourse, but in our political discourse too. Earlier this month, in an interview with The New Yorker, Aaron David Miller, a veteran US State Department advisor who has worked on Middle East policy for multiple presidents, let the cat out of the bag. Do I think that Joe Biden has the same depth of feeling and empathy for the Palestinians of Gaza as he does for the Israelis? No, he doesn't. Nor does he convey it. I don't think there's any doubt about that. We have a word for this phenomenon of caring more about the suffering of one group of human beings over another, of prioritising one group of people over another based on their nationality, their ethnicity. It's called racism. Now, One of the reasons I founded Zateo, which officially launches this week, and one of the reasons I'm hosting this new weekly show for Zateo, is that I'm fed up with media organizations failing to challenge the racism and bigotry of our leaders. And I'm also fed up with media organizations themselves pushing racist, bigoted, dehumanizing coverage of minorities across the board, but especially of the Palestinians. I think the world deserves better. I think the American people in particular deserve better. Because here's what's so fascinating. Poll after poll shows the American people support a ceasefire. One poll in February found half of all Americans believe Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. And that's after being exposed only to our current, awful, one-sided media coverage of this issue. Imagine what those numbers would look like if we had a media that actually showed Americans what's happening on the ground in Gaza, that gave Palestinians a voice, a platform, or actually treated Palestinians as victims of Israeli violence, as human beings deserving of our compassion, our empathy, our solidarity. Imagine what a world we could live in if we had a media like that.
I was looking around on the web to see what other community radio stations are doing with regard to the genocide, and I found this radio station in Australia that has a program. It's actually dated for Saturday, April 20th, 2024, and it is about the genocide in Gaza. Here it is.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Sabah al-khair. Good morning, dear listeners. You're listening to Radio 3CR on 855 AM and Palestine Remembered with Robert Martin, Nasser Mashni, and Yusuf Ahmed al-Rimawi.
Palestine Remembered is Australia's only English-language radio program that is totally dedicated to Palestine. We'd like to welcome those listening on 855 and those that will join us on podcast at 3cr.org.au.
Thanks for joining us. Stay with us and enjoy the episode.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Palestine Remembered. Here we are, six and a bit months later, and still fighting strong. I'm so very, very proud, not just of the Palestinian community's resilience in steadfastness in Gaza, not just because of their strength, their courage, their indomitable spirit, their unbreakability, but I'm so, so very proud of our community in diaspora, wherever that might be, and particularly in the global north, in those countries like this settler colony where Palestinians have been silenced and others othered, and that they are continuing to stand up, show up, fight out. And if you look at the array of actions and how they represent themselves, whether it's the Sunday rallies in Melbourne or community pickets at HTA, at Hume actions on Monday, and very importantly this weekend, this Monday, all across the world, the A15 movement. If you don't know what that is, just Google it. But it's a worldwide call for solidarity with Palestine to shut the entire system down. So there are many things you can do. You can click on and see the activities that have been publicly listed. But I'm very, I'm looking forward to finding out all the stuff that I don't know about that's going to happen by crew all over Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Adelaide. So as a human being, what you can do is stay home. Unplug from capitalism, unplug from the system that profiteers. One of the challenges, you know, you think about our Prime Minister and his background and where he's got to and what we've become. He's pivoting Australia as a manufacturing place, creating jobs, but in the war machine. And we need to absolutely hold him to account to principles of humanity, and that's actually unplugging ourselves from the supply chain that is perpetuating this genocide in Gaza to every little bit. So You can do it from home. Unplug. Don't watch commercial TV. Stay at home. Read a book. Don't send your kids to school. There are many ways you can do it. Or have a look at A15 and find out what public events are on. You don't actually have to put yourself at the front line if that's not something you want to do. But all credit to that crew wherever they are, and well done, and keep it up. During the week, we had a couple of things that happened. Peter Dutton described the Opera House protest. The Opera House protest, where for the best part of 4 months, the virulent, hateful Israel groups, anti-Palestinian groups, perpetuated the lie of the doctored audio, which we knew was doctored within 24 hours, that people were chanting, "Gas the Jews." They perpetuated that. The videos have had hundreds of millions of views, contributed with the rest of the Hasbara, the 40 beheaded babies in ovens, manufacturing consent, you know, as Noam Chomsky said, manufacturing consent for the dehumanization of Palestinians, that allowed for unfettered Western diplomatic and media and military support of this genocidal, racist, fascist regime and the genocide they have perpetuated on Palestine. That Peter Dutton, in hyperbole, said that this rally was like Port Arthur Massacre, where 35 innocent people were gunned down by a crazed madman. The politicisation of Palestine, the football that Peter Dutton has decided to make Australian Palestinians, Australian Arabs, Muslim or Christians, Australians who are supporting Palestine, into a football that he kicks around is just disgusting. Now, I imagine anybody listening to this podcast and this show would never vote for Peter Dutton. But if you do see him going to dinner, I'd urge you to make sure that his dinner is really uncomfortable. During the week also, we had, you know, a brilliant piece of colonial advocacy. Penny Wong decided that even though it's part of the ALP national platform, and has been since 2018, that they would endeavour to save Israel by advancing the case for recognition of Palestine. Well, Labor, Prime Minister Albanese, Foreign Minister Penny Wong, Palestine exists. It exists in the hearts and minds of billions of people. Australia's diplomatic recognition of a Palestinian state is way, way overdue. In fact, 77 years overdue, because we should never have partitioned Palestine. The fact that Australia recognised Israel without a border, with a government that was made up of terrorists from the Irgun, Stern and Haganah that were wanted by the British police, many of whom were Aussie diggers, only months and weeks before that recognition was conferred on it, is a shame. Australia prides itself on the fact that it was the first country to recognise the State of Israel in the UN. That's because the aardvarks didn't show up, and so Australia was next cab off the rank. It should be something we are ashamed of, the partitioning of a historic land that all of Abraham's children had a connection to, into a piece of land that was Jewish only, or a Jewish state, separating families, disconnecting, and resulting in the ethnic cleansing and Nakba. It's something that'd be shameful. Australia has decided that its recognition would, of course, be conditional on Hamas not being part of it. Well, let me tell you something. You don't get to decide. You don't get to decide who represents Palestine. You don't get to decide who represents Palestinians. Palestinians will decide whomever should be recognising them. And it's entirely up to them. This concept of a colonial ideology that you get to decide is unacceptable, and we don't accept it. During the week, we had a couple of good news stories. I call them good news stories. The McDonald's Corporation, you know, no fan of McDonald's Corporation, obviously, due to the damage the ongoing boycott McDonald's is facing all over the world, bought back 225 Israeli franchises from the master franchisor there. So they're now owned by McDonald's Corporation and no longer by that guy that decided to give free burgers to tank drivers. I'm not sure what they think that means, that they'll get us to stop not buying their shit products. I certainly am not going there again, and I'd commend all of you not to do the same. But also Samsung has an investment arm that had an office in Israel. On Tuesday, they packed up lock, stock, barrel, and said, we're out of here. I didn't write their press release, but it would have said something like, we don't want to be involved with the genocidal regime. We don't want to tarnish the brand. We don't want to tarnish our products. We don't want to be associated with a regime that can commit these sorts of crimes. We are an honourable company and want to move on, because, you know, there is just no way that you accidentally kill 20,000 children. There's just no way that you accidentally target refugee camps. There's no way you accidentally kill over 100 journalists, 250 aid workers. You don't accidentally attack 35 hospitals. You don't accidentally destroy 350,000 homes. You don't accidentally displace 2 million people. That happens because you got a plan. And so Samsung doesn't want to be involved or associated with that plan, and good on them. Go to, please, search up the Albert petition. There's a federal petition for Albert. Closes in only 3 days, and there'll be a launch of one in the state, a state Albert action in the coming week. So look out for that. And very quickly before we go to a song, and we've got a really dear friend coming after the song, UNICEF was targeted. You know, the reportage here. They had a very photogenic Australian former reporter, Tess Ingham. She said, we were driving away from the Israeli checkpoint when we got shot at and the civilians dispersed. What then gets reported was, you know, shots were fired at the UNICEF convoy. You know, it seems Israel hasn't killed enough Australian aid workers. Just shocking. I want to bring Giselle in just very quickly. The Australia-Asia Workers Link, they're having a movie fundraiser called The Lab. This is done by Jotam Feldman. Tuesday, 23rd of April, 6 p.m., CFMEU, level 7, 540 Elizabeth Street, followed by a Q&A with the film's director, Jotam Feldman. Giselle, tell us a little bit more.
Well, The Lab is a documentary that was actually made in 2013. It is about the Israeli military industry and the profits they make by testing weapons in the occupied territories. They then sell these weapons and market them by saying they were tested in combat. They sell them to basically local police forces in the United States for urban warfare. India, for example, is the biggest buyer of Israeli weapons. I know that the BDS campaign here in Australia and since October 7 has really focused on arms supply to Israel, which is obviously really, really important. But the other side of that is the gazillion dollars in profits that Israel makes in weapons sales and weapons manufacturing themselves. So this is a documentary about that. Jotam Feldman is an Israeli, so if that's a problem for people, which I respect, this is not the evening for you. But Jotam is a journalist. He writes for Haaretz, which is a progressive paper in Israel that Netanyahu's trying to shut down because their coverage of Gaza right now is that Gaza is a genocidal war zone and that Netanyahu's a maniac.
Mm-hmm. Well, Netanyahu is a maniac. So make sure you get along. We'll put details in the podcast.
That's right. I'll just give out my number. If you do want to come along, give me a ring and I'll help you get tickets, 0411054859.
Well, nobody's going to pick that. It was really quick.
I didn't want to take up too much time on your
show. No, sorry. Just nice and slowly.
0411054859.
You can listen back in the podcast if you've missed that. And make sure you listen to the podcast and then share it with your friends too. So I've got a song here. And straight after that, we're going to be joined by Tony Piccolo from the Australian Metal Workers Union.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven Here to stay.
Don't give up the fight. Absolutely. Bob Marley, get up and stand up. And it's so amazing that somebody as principled and a fighter like Bob Marley could give birth to a kid like Ziggy, who's just, you know, a shame and a blight on his father. And it must have been, I'm going to suggest there's maybe no actual Bob Marley DNA in Ziggy, that he's coming out of nowhere. Because for those that don't know, Ziggy Marley is a big defender of the IDF, has fronted fundraisers for the IDF, performed in Adelaide at WOMAD, where WOMAD, the festival there, disinvited Soul 47, a Palestinian band. So rest in peace, Bob, and unfortunately you don't have the peace you deserve, because there's a shit stain of a human carrying your surname. We're joined by Tony Piccolo, who's the State Assistant Secretary of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, guys. How are we?
Yeah, really well, brother. Really well. Great to have you on. Now, Tony, you're a staunch friend of Palestine. You're a staunch human being. I know you've spoken at our rallies. You've been front and centre, understanding that Palestine is union business. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to that place?
Oh, well, the AMWU and the union movement have got a long tradition of international solidarity and standing up for workers around the world, whether locally or internationally. Because the international struggle, workers' struggle, is oppression and, you know, apartheid and killing of women and children always affect workers, whether it's healthcare workers, you know, while being victims of a war, are standing up, and while being victims themselves, are treating victims. So we take that as our responsibility very strongly, and it's a cause that's dear to my heart. And this started well before what occurred in the recent war. We had an international solidarity initiative. We put a motion at the last state council, past state ALP conference, calling for the recognition of the Palestinian state well before the war. But more importantly, you know, my union was at the forefront of the anti-Vietnam War, and it started from very humble beginnings. I think, the first rally we held had five participants, and it grew and grew, and until we were at a stage to win the public support to end the war in our participation in the war
in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, yes, that's right.
Absolutely. Now, Tony, you were in last year. We were talking about the conference motion. You were instrumental in getting the Victorian State Labor into passing a motion for the recognition of Palestine. Well done. Tell us a little bit about how that the politics of that works.
Well, it was not without raised eyebrows and others that were involved. It wasn't just got broad cross-factional support, but both from the left and the right. But that being said, there was pressure to remove the motion, to put down the motion. But we had to stand tall with our beliefs and our support of the Palestinian struggle and the opposition of oppression, wherever that raised its head. And so did raise many phone calls and many conversations, but I was proud to play my small part and very proud to represent the AMWU on that matter.
Well, it's no small part. The AMWU and yourself and your intervention of yourself and Tony Mav, sincerely appreciate it, brother. The reality, a lot in our community that's pissed off with the Labor Party. I mean, let's not muck around there. But we've got another conference coming up, and you know, based on the reportage you hear about elbows coming, Jacinta's upset. What's that looking like? I mean, you've got a motion up.
We've drafted a motion, and this time we've gone broader reach in terms of the drafting of the motion. It's a robust motion. It's going to be caucused amongst supportive left unions, and then once we've settled on some words, we'll take that out to the broader ALP collective.
Correct.
But I want to touch on a comment you made, Nasser. And I agree there are a lot of people upset with the Labor Party, and I would implore people the only way to change the Labor Party get involved in the Labor Party and change it from the ground up. And so the Labor Party is one of the most democratic institutions in the globe. So get involved, get active, join, and let's change the direction of where this party is going. Arrogant or naive, but state conference coming up, I don't think it's any accident that Penny Wong has, you know, called it was the, you know, perhaps we should recognise the state of Palestine during this conflict, and that is years of work, decades of work from the Labor movement, and I think is in direct response to what has been reported to may occur at this state conference.
Thanks for that, Tony. I mean, whatever comrades out there, whatever their orientation is towards the Labor Party, I think you're right. It really is clear that it's the pressure from the ground that's caused a lot of these changes in positions. But I reckon a lot of that pressure too comes from within the union movement. One of the most inspiring things I've seen in the last 6 months is this explosion of rank and file union activity for what is basically an international solidarity campaign. You and I have been international solidarity trade unionists for 20 years, 25 years. This rank and file commitment, is that the biggest thing you've seen in your time as a unionist?
When it comes to international solidarity, yes, it is. I think this is for the first time where the average worker, the average unionist, the average person is saying, well, what is actually going on over there? And they're doing their own research and finding out that what is occurring and the oppression that is occurring is unsustainable and abhorrent. And so people are genuinely shocked, amazed and horrified at what they're seeing on the ground and the support that is being given to them, to the Israeli government and their military, from Western powers. And you know, what people need to understand is, while people like Joe Biden are wagging the finger, if they actually stop the export of arms to those countries, to Israel, then the bombs would stop overnight because they don't have enough.
Thanks so very much, Tony. You're 100% right. It's really important, like Tony touched on earlier on, you know, peace is union business. Palestine is union business. I don't imagine it's the case, but if you're listening to the show and you're not a member of your union, join your union. The workers united will never be defeated. Yeah. So we need you to join a union. And if you already are a unionist, you've heard from Tony Piccolo that Palestine is union business. Get active, get involved. Tony, a couple of minutes. You got anything else you want to add, brother?
I want to agree with your statement there, Nasser, but also how you can get active within your union, attend the rallies on Sunday. You know, some of the most joyous rallies I've been to. And no worker in this world should be left behind. Not in our name, not in the union's name. I'm proud to stand side by side with those fighting for a more just and free world.
Yeah, brilliant, Tony. Thanks so very much, mate. That was Tony Piccolo from the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union. He's the Assistant State Secretary. We've got a few minutes left. I just want to quickly speak to what's happening geopolitically on the ground. And there's a ratcheting up of dialogue around Iran, etc. I mean, let's be clear. Israel targeted an Iranian embassy in a different country. That's an attack on a foreign government. If Iran had targeted the Israeli embassy, then we know exactly what would have happened. But there's this notion that America is going to come to the aid of Iran. And for many of us, we sit in this space and think, how can that really happen? But I think just very quickly, I'm going to run through some points for us to consider about just how absurd that actually is. And just so you know, Austrian Airlines has stopped flights into Tehran. There's a whole bunch of language around what's happening. But Tehran's east, you'll find Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Turkmenistan. There's no way you can put troops there. Remember when they went into Gulf War One? It took 6 months to get all of the troops into Saudi Arabia before they went into Iraq, yeah? And Iran's had a long time to prepare based on what they've seen in Iraq, etc. So to the south, you've got the Persian Gulf, which, Iran completely dominates, so you can't get battleships into there. To the west, you've got Iraq and Turkey. The first, there's no chance they can do it out of Iraq. I mean, depending on who you listen to, that's almost Iran now. Turkey is not going to go to war with Iran for Israel and the US. That would be deeply unpopular with the Turkish people. Tehran's north is the Caspian Sea. No chance of doing that. Azerbaijan and Armenia. I mean, that's kind of an opening. But how will you get tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of troops there? It's physically, a challenge. You'd have to go through Istanbul to do it. It's politically complicated and no real chance. Remembering that it's going to take months to get the sort of troop level required to get to that point. There's just no way to get that level of human beings and tanks, etc., to the place. Iran has an arsenal of thousands of guided weapons. It's got missiles, it's got satellites in space, it's got capabilities of thousands of kilometres. It's got drones. Additionally, they've got the most sophisticated anti-ship missile stuff. The language and what they're talking about doing a full-scale invasion is just beyond the pale or any chance of happening. And when it happens, if it happens, what's the price of oil going to be? And the biggest manufacturer of oil, Russia, $200, $300, $400, $500 a barrel, they'll rise in economic power and this will hasten the decline of Western hegemony and the US empire. So don't be sucked in by what that looks like. It would be a disaster for us all. We're coming to the end of the show. Thank you so very much for listening. Make sure you share the podcast, tell your friends, and remember, there's never been a better time for a free Palestine. Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters. On behalf of the Gumbanja Nation, my people, who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And that was from community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
At Al Jazeera's investigative unit, we've conducted a forensic, meticulous examination of the events of October the 7th. We uncovered very real crimes committed by Hamas and others. But I think what was perhaps most significant were the crimes we discovered that did not happen. And it's hugely concerning that these revelations have been virtually entirely ignored by the Western press. What's extraordinary is the Israelis were aware of the plans. Hamas were actually training quite openly for this operation, and they were actually placing the training videos online so anyone could view them. On the very night of October the 7th, before dawn, spotters along the fence are reporting back to headquarters, and the head of Shin Bet and the head of military intelligence take this seriously enough that in the middle of the night, they're up and talking to each other, and they conclude it's just another training exercise. And what is extraordinary is that they don't even raise the alert level to number one, you know, the most basic alert level would have made a huge difference. And they don't do that, which means that when Hamas bursts through the fence at 6:30 in the morning, they catch many of the defenders in their beds. I mean, you can see many of the soldiers are killed in their beds. Hamas had anticipated most of their fighters would be killed trying to get through the fence. In fact, only a small number were killed trying to get through the fence. They were as much taken by surprise as anyone by the performance of Israeli intelligence and the Israeli military. Crucially, also, they were taken by surprise by this very large music festival that was taking place, which they don't seem to have been aware of. Having overrun the military bases, the game plan was to grab hostages and take them back. And they do this on a large scale, but they also clearly kill very large numbers of unarmed civilians as well. The Israelis were then extraordinarily slow to respond. Now, they scramble Apache helicopters, but there's no ground control. It's pretty clear that in the chaos, some hostages at least were hit by Apache helicopter fire. We've identified 27 people who were clearly taken hostage, taken captive, and were taken away from their homes, but never made it to the fence, died somewhere between their homes and the fence. There's a fair chance that a number of them were killed by Apache helicopters. Within the kibbutzes, we've identified 18 people who were pretty much certainly killed by the police and the army as they arrived. 12 of them, a specific incident in kibbutz Beri, where you have a large number of gunmen, around 40 gunmen, holed up in a house with 13 hostages. A tank is brought in and opens fire on the house. There are two survivors from this incident, which is why we know about it. There may be other incidents we don't know about because everyone was killed, but there are two survivors from this who spoke to Israeli media. There's a common sense thing. You just have to look at the scale of the destruction, and it's clear that 1,200 men armed with rocket-propelled grenades and machine guns did not do all of this. The Hannibal Directive, which was something that was developed in the 1980s by the Israelis, and it was basically to avoid situations where their enemies would capture one or two or three Israeli soldiers and then effectively hold them to ransom. There was one occasion where the Israelis released over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in return for a single Israeli soldier. So an order was issued whereby they said, it's better that we kill everyone than allow people to be captured. Now, this was supposedly rescinded several years ago, but at midday on October the 7th, the army revived the Hannibal Directive, put it into effect. 70 vehicles were hit. At least in some of the cases, everyone in the vehicle was killed.
The Israeli military does not deny the report.
The peculiarity of the days after October 7 is that the Israeli media and subsequently the international media choose to focus not on the very real and extensive crimes that Hamas and others did commit, but on crimes they did not commit. And this had two focuses. In the days immediately after, it's to do with babies. The most dramatic one is we see an allegation that there were 40 babies killed, many of them beheaded. This is very simple to deal with because we have a comprehensive list of the dead. We know that two babies are killed on October the 7th. One is a 10-month-old child who is hit by a bullet fired through a safe room door. The other is a child who dies after an emergency cesarean, a Bedouin child, in fact. Now, any story about babies that does not relate to those two, and there are a lot of stories about babies, is not true. We know it's not true. This has enormous implications for the other wave of atrocity stories that began very quickly, which is to do with sexual violence, and particularly the Israeli assertion that it was widespread and systematic. To be clear, in the film, we are not saying that there were no rapes on October the 7th. We simply don't know. What we are saying is that there simply is not the evidence There's not the forensic evidence, there's not the visual evidence, there's not the photographic evidence, and there is not the witness evidence to support the allegation of widespread and systematic rape. The Israelis have this strange system where they farm out the collection of bodies after disasters and terrorist attacks and so on to an organization called Zaka, who are ultra-Orthodox religious volunteers. They collect the bodies, prepare them for religious burial and so on. A character that many people will have seen in the days afterwards is Yossi Landau, who was the southern commander of Zaka, who was on television a great deal. He said,
"The two piles of 10 children each were tied to the back, burned to death."
You then see a phone call which Netanyahu makes to President Biden, where he repeats this story. In fact, he embellishes it.
"They took dozens of children, bound them up, burned them, and executed them."
Terribly important, this, because it was entirely untrue. We know the house he's talking about. He's talking about the house in Kibbutz Be'eri, which was the house that was stormed by Israeli police and military, and where it is almost certain that all of the hostages were killed by the Israeli police and military. There were two children there, two twins, but no other children. So we know the story is untrue. Mr. Landau told a number of other stories. There's one particularly notorious one about the fetus being cut out of a pregnant woman.
"The baby that was connected to the cord was stabbed, and she was shot in the back."
We simply know this is untrue. The list of the dead show there's no such victim. Mr. Landau said, "You know, I have a picture of this atrocity.
If you want to see the picture, I have the picture of it.
This is the baby."
"I'm sorry to be graphic here, but I can't see a baby here."
"You can't see the baby because, but this is the picture of the mother."
It was a piece of charred flesh. It wasn't a baby. It certainly wasn't a baby. So it was interesting. I mean, psychologically, I'm not quite sure why he offered to show me a photo that he didn't have. I'd point out as well that Zaka was an organization that was in trouble. There had been a major scandal. Its founder had been accused of child sexual abuse. There was a financial scandal. It had been found to be cooking the books. It's raised an awful lot of money since October the 7th. These stories were clearly useful, and they were useful to the Israeli government. In the film, we see Benjamin Netanyahu visiting Zaka volunteers and thanking them for talking to the world's media and stressing that this is another front in the war. Why does this matter? Why does it matter whether this type of atrocity was committed but not that type? People were killed in this way, not that way. It matters because the murder of babies and widespread rape has a particular resonance. It's particularly triggering the Israeli government and its supporters when they justify the brutality of the subsequent bombardment and invasion of the Gaza Strip. Again and again and again, what they always reference is babies and rape.
"Young girls who were raped and then murdered.
Women brutally raped and murdered.
Little kids who are beheaded.
Pictures of terrorists beheading children.
These bastards put these babies in an oven and put on the oven. We found the kid a few hours later."
This is something you see in previous conflicts as well. If you want to dehumanize an enemy, if you want to desensitize people to the suffering that is inflicted on that enemy, then you portray them as barbarians, basically as savages, as people who are not deserving of humane treatment. And that's why it's relevant. That's why it's important to pick apart. A lot of the world's leading media outlets have done in-depth investigations where they have concluded there was widespread, systematic, instrumentalized, weaponized rape. The New York Times makes a particular feature of the story of a young woman. She was killed early in the morning, 9 miles north of the music festival site as she and her husband were fleeing. The New York Times, in its big December investigation into sexual violence, leads with this, and about a third of the article consists of her story. And it's immediately undermined because the woman's sister then posts on Instagram immediately afterwards, "This isn't true. We know she wasn't raped. She was texting us until minutes before her death." It's also the case that her husband had a lengthy phone conversation immediately after her death with his brother, and again, made no mention of rape. So it's very important that, because it's the central, most compelling piece of information in one of the biggest investigations done by one of the world's most prestigious media outlets, the New York Times, and it turns out not to be true. It's done by three journalists. One of them turns out to be somebody who worked in some capacity for Israeli intelligence previously, who has virtually no journalistic experience, and who had liked genocidal media posts. It's very interesting with Anna Schwartz. She gives an interview in Hebrew to an Israeli channel, she actually lays out how difficult they were finding it to find evidence that they were talking to all the hospitals and all the psychiatric clinics and so on, and that there was simply no evidence at all. There were no witnesses had come forward, no victims had come forward at all. I think she's telling this as if to show what digging they had to do, but it's actually very revealing. In the end, it's quite clear they fall back on the same sources as everyone else: Israeli government officials, IDF officers, and first responders, all sources which were discredited by the baby stories. So no babies were beheaded, no babies were thrown into ovens, and there is no real evidence for widespread and systematic rape. Now, it's very clear why the Israelis might want these stories to circulate. What's less clear is why very reputable Western news and media outlets should swallow them so uncritically, particularly given the track record of the Israeli government and the IDF, which has been shown again and again and again in the past to have been less than truthful in the accounts it gives.
Because our war is against Hamas, not against the people of Gaza. While this mission is urgent, we will continue to fulfill it with care and with a commitment to the sanctity of life, both Israeli and Palestinian.
The response to our film, October the 7th, has been interesting. The response is not to criticise and to pick apart and say we've got it wrong. They don't do that at all. What they do is they simply ignore you, which on one level I take as a compliment, because I think there are all sorts of people out there who would very much like to pick apart what we're doing and to destroy it and discredit it. And I think they take one look at it and decide they can't really do it. So what they do, which in a way is even more damaging, is just to entirely ignore us. This is significant because so often what we are doing is critiquing the way the mainstream media has covered the story, which may well be, of course, precisely why the media doesn't want to look at what we've done. So in a way, the treatment of this in many ways echoes the treatment of our earlier series, The Labour Files, which offered a critique of the dominant media narrative about Corbyn and the Corbyn years on the anti-Semitism crisis. The allegation of anti-Semitism clearly is a very powerful weapon that can be wielded in defence of the Israeli state. I think sometimes, particularly by the Israeli state, it is wielded very cynically and very deliberately.
When the ICC investigates Israel for fake war crimes, this is pure anti-Semitism.
It's not the case in Western media and Western societies that you cannot criticise Israel. You can. Now, you have to be a bit careful about how you do it. But certainly at the moment, during the assault on Gaza, you certainly can. What you cannot do is to question the fundamental philosophy of Zionism. What you are not allowed to do is to say what all Palestinians would say: Israel is a state whose defining feature is and has always been that it is structured to ensure the domination of one ethnicity over another, that it is in effect an apartheid state, which is what all of the world's human rights organizations now describe it as. The enormous peculiarity and dysfunction of Western media with Israel is not only does it not say that, you're actually not allowed to say that. And this renders criticism of Israel perilous terrain. People are very on edge. They're very aware that they're straying into dangerous territory. They're very aware they have to choose their words terribly carefully, otherwise they will be misconstrued. You can see this happening at its worst within the Labour Party, where particularly Jewish people are far, far more likely to be suspended and expelled for anti-Semitism from the Labour Party than non-Jewish people. But there is something more fundamental that goes on, which regards the Palestinian people as a whole. Once you have tainted them with the stain of anti-Semitism, you have opened the door to, you have facilitated the dehumanization of Palestinians, which is the psychological prerequisite of Israeli brutality towards the Palestinians and of Western complicity in that brutality. Palestinians will often make the point that they did not choose who their occupier was, who their colonizer was. So in fighting back, yes, they are inevitably fighting back against Zionists and Jews. It doesn't mean they're anti-Semitic. One has to ask oneself the question, are we really saying that if they had been colonized by Greeks or Italians, they wouldn't be resisting their occupation? Of course they would. 36 Israeli children were killed on October the 7th, and this understandably got widespread international media coverage. At this stage, I think over 14,000 Palestinian children have been killed, and you would expect the outrage and the coverage to be proportionately greater, and it's not. in future people will look back at what is being done, which is essentially the flattening of a whole series of towns and the mass murder of thousands and thousands of unarmed civilians, almost half of whom are children, and they will be absolutely bewildered by how the West allowed this to happen under its very noses with weapons that were being supplied by the West. There is a rupture in the relationship of large numbers of people with the political media class. There is a fundamental alienation that is going on right now as a result of what is happening in the Gaza Strip. I think that's very dangerous for the future. The events of October the 7th are a case study in how traditional media can let us down and how we desperately need alternative voices that will genuinely probe these things and not simply accept the narratives that are fed to them. For this reason, I think it's enormously important to have outlets like Double Down News, and I would urge you to support Double Down News in any way you can.
And next we have a media statement by Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont.
Thanks very much for joining me. As I'm sure all Americans know, the war in Gaza began on October 7th when Hamas, a terrorist organization, invaded Israel, killed some 1,200 innocent men, women, and children, and took over 230 people into captivity, many of whom are still being held. It has always been my view that Israel had a right to defend itself, respond to this attack, and go after Hamas. It is also my view that Israel does not have the right to go to war against the entire Palestinian people, which is exactly what it is doing. Let's discuss briefly what's going on in Gaza. There are about 2.2 million people living in Gaza, mostly poor and struggling people. Since the war began, over 33,000 Palestinians have been killed and 77,000 wounded. Unbelievably, 5% of the residents of Gaza have been killed or wounded in a six-month period. Two-thirds of these people are women and children. Since the war began, 1.7 million people, over 75% of the population, have been driven from their homes. Over 60% of the housing units in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed. This housing destruction is unprecedented in modern history. But it's not just housing. Israel has systematically destroyed the healthcare system in Gaza. Gaza had 36 hospitals before the war. Now just 11 are partially operational. Persistent attacks on healthcare facilities have killed more than 400 healthcare workers. But it's not just housing and the healthcare system. It's the physical civilian infrastructure in Gaza, which is also being destroyed. More than half of the water and sanitation systems have been put out of commission. Only one of three water pipes is operating. Clean drinking water is severely limited, and sewage, raw sewage, is running through the streets, spreading disease. And as we speak, there is virtually no electricity in Gaza. But it's not just housing and healthcare and infrastructure that is being destroyed. There are 12 universities in Gaza. Unbelievably, each and every one of them has been either damaged or destroyed. In addition, primary and secondary schools have also been completely disrupted. 625,000 students have no access to an education. And as horrible as all of this is, there is something happening now that is even worse. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinian children face starvation. People in Gaza struggle to survive from day to day, foraging for leaves, eating animal feed, or splitting the occasional aid package amongst their families. At least 28 children have died of malnutrition and dehydration already, but the real toll is likely much higher. Let's be clear. These conditions are the result of Israel's arbitrary restrictions on the aid getting into Gaza. This is not a matter of debate. It is an obvious reality, that numerous humanitarian organizations have repeatedly confirmed. For months, thousands of trucks carrying life-saving supplies have sat just miles away from starving children, prevented from reaching their destination by unreasonable Israeli restrictions and a military campaign conducted with little regard for civilian life. Blocking desperately needed U.S. humanitarian aid is obscene and unacceptable. It is also a violation of American law. The Foreign Assistance Act is clear. No U.S. assistance may be provided to any country that, quote, prohibits or otherwise restricts, directly or indirectly, the transport or delivery of United States humanitarian assistance, end of quote. Israel is clearly in violation of that law. What Israel is doing today in Gaza and the West Bank is a defining moment for Americans, because we are directly complicit in this horrific war. The U.S. military is not dropping 2,000-pound bombs on civilian apartment buildings, but we are supplying those bombs. The U.S. is not blocking the borders and preventing food, water, and medical supplies from getting to desperate people, but we have supplied billions of dollars to the Netanyahu government, which is doing just that. The U.S. is not annexing occupied Palestinian land, but it is providing political protection for the Israeli government as it does that. Despite the massive financial and military support the U.S. has provided to Israel for many years, the right-wing extremist government of Benjamin Netanyahu has ignored increasingly urgent calls from the U.S. to end the humanitarian disaster in Gaza, to stop settlement expansion in the West Bank, and to lay out initial steps for a two-state solution. The American people have had enough. Poll after poll shows that they are fed up with Netanyahu's war against the Palestinian people and do not want to see their taxpayer dollars support the slaughter of innocent civilians and the starvation of children. The United States has offered Israel unconditional financial support for many years. In recent years, that has amounted to $3.8 billion a year, with numerous additional forms of support. Right now, against my vote, Congress is considering another $14 billion in military aid for Israel, $10 billion of which is completely unrestricted military funding. That unconditional support must now end. Instead of begging Netanyahu's extremist government to protect innocent lives and obey U.S. law and international law, our position must be simple and straightforward. Not another nickel for the Netanyahu government if their present policies continue. The United States must use all of the leverage we have to secure an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and across the region, and demand that the massive amount of humanitarian assistance that is needed to prevent famine and widespread humanitarian suffering is able to flow into Gaza. History will judge what we do right now. History will judge whether we stand with starving children, whether we uphold America's professed values, or whether we continue to blindly finance Netanyahu's war machine. Thank you.
And that was the media statement of Bernie Sanders on April 18th, 2024.